Welcome back to Lungcast, the monthly respiratory health podcast series from the American Lung Association and medical news site, hcplive.com. I'm your host, Dr. Albert Rizzo, the Chief Medical Officer of the American Lung Association. Before we introduce our topic and our guest today, just a reminder that Lungcast is available on all your favorite streaming platforms. Subscribe to @Lungcast on YouTube to get new and archived episodes, as well as interview segments and episode highlights as they come out. A link to the show page, as well as the American Lung Association and HCP Live homepages for Lungcast, can be found in each episode description. And for those of you who prefer a podcast, you can subscribe to Lungcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and your favorite listening platforms. You can also register for more respiratory news and insights at both lung.org and hcplive.com. So the patient diagnosed with lung cancer today often has a much different journey in their care than those diagnosed 15 to 20 years ago. There's been the initiation of low-dose lung cancer screening, shifting the diagnosis to earlier, more curable and treatable stages, and there's been an explosion of new therapies. These include targetable mutations and immunotherapy. Today's discussion will focus on the actionable targeted mutations. And this aspect of precision oncology has fundamentally changed how we diagnose and treat lung cancer. This change in the management of lung cancer patients has been driven by what's called oncogene-addicted advanced stage non-small cell lung cancers, which are identified by the presence of specific biomarkers. The term oncogene addiction is a phenomenon in which tumor cells become dependent on a single oncogenic protein or pathway to sustain their malignant properties. And this dependency allows the oncogene to fuel and support the malignant phenotype of the tumor cells. Now, as increasing amounts of identifiable oncogenes have led to the development of molecular targeted drugs that include small molecular tyrosine kinase inhibitors, or TKIs, monoclonal antibodies, and antibody drug conjugates. The targeted therapies for these mutations have shown significant improvement in response rates, progression-free survival, and overall survival compared to traditional chemotherapy. Today, we hope to address this category of drugs that are considered targeted, their drug toxicities, and the resistance it can develop, and also some of the hurdles that exist in using them. To address this topic today, our guest is Dr. Jacob Sands. Dr. Sands is a thoracic medical oncologist at Dana-Farber Cancer Institute and assistant professor of medicine in Harvard Medical School. Dr. Sands joined Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in 2017, where he sees individuals with lung cancer and leads the small cell lung cancer clinical research program. Dr. Sands has published a number of manuscripts on lung cancer and is leading many active clinical trials treating lung cancer. He's a member of the National Comprehensive Cancer Network, or NCCN, Guidelines Committee on small cell lung cancer and lung screening. Despite keeping busy with patients and these other duties, he finds time to act as a volunteer national medical spokesperson for the American Lung Association. Thank you, Dr. Sands, for being here today and for all you do with the American Lung Association.
It's such a pleasure to chat with you today. Thank you.
So let's start out with the NCCN guidelines and talk about, they talk about the importance of tumor testing or biomarker testing. And when treating lung cancer, the most commonly recommended biomarkers include EGFR, or epidermal growth factor receptor, ALK, ROS1, CRAS, BRF, BRAF, on and on. And it seems like almost every few weeks, another oncogene driver is being identified, which is good because those then lead to potential drugs for targeting. So as a first step today, could you tell our listeners about how these biomarkers are obtained and discuss next generation sequencing, the pros and the cons of both tissue and blood biomarkers?
Absolutely. This is a great question. It's kind of a mouthful, all these different biomarkers and genomic alterations. And we say genomic alterations because we have mutations and we also have fusions. And those are a little bit different, but essentially these are mistakes, we can say, in the DNA of the cells. And this is specifically of the cancer cells. These types of, I'm just going to broadly say mutations for all of them, although I've described that really the proper term would probably be alterations. But all these mutations, These are in the cancer DNA. This is not something that's passed down from generation to generation. It's something that occurs that then turns the cells into cancer cells. It becomes an oncogenic driver, or essentially an alteration or mutation that is driving that cell and making it a cancer. Now, there is a lot to discuss. And I just want to highlight that this is fairly recent. In 2009, there was a trial published called the IPASS trial. Now, in that trial, it was non-squamous, non-small cell lung cancer that enrolled to that study. So basically, the biggest group of non-small cell lung cancer, the biggest diagnosis group of non-small cell lung cancer. And in that study, it involved a drug that is a targeted drug for EGFR. At the time, we didn't really know for sure that that was. And in the study, as part of the study, they looked at these EGFR mutations. There wasn't yet a defined treatment for that. And what they found in this is that in the cancers that had one of these EGFR mutations, that targeted therapy worked overwhelmingly better. In the tumors that did not have that EGFR mutation, the chemotherapy worked overwhelmingly better. Now, up until that point, that targeted therapy was an approved drug as a second line for everybody because it wasn't yet established that there is a biomarker, let alone the fact that that biomarker is, in fact, a driver of that cell actually being a tumor. So this is in 2009 where that kind of shift happened. And although the story always starts earlier, you could call that certainly as a starting point in the targeted therapies for lung cancer. So that was 2009. In the last 15 years, as you've said, on top of EGFR and now having a number of drugs that work for EGFR mutation, we now have ALK, ROS1, RET, BRAF V600E, MET exon 14 skipping mutation, NTRK, and KRAS G12C is a specific one. So in the last 15 years, we now have approved drugs that target all of those. Which is just to make the point that all of that funding for lung cancer research, that is actually leading to big advances in the field that in the last 15 years we've seen this. So the targeted therapy, which is the targeted therapy era, which is what we're now discussing, has really been explosive in the last 15 years. And also just one more point to that before getting more specifically to the question is that anybody with lung cancer now, with some rare exceptions, anyone getting lung cancer will be treated with a drug that is newly developed within the last 5 to 10 years. So the science is moving very rapidly, and thankfully, the pace is increasing. So it's getting academically exciting. It is tragic that anyone needs this science, that we need to develop these things. But it is exciting that given that there is need, we are really making very big advances. And everything we're talking about right now is entirely new, essentially within the last 15 years and even more recent as part of the discussion. Now, to the point about genomic testing, so we've mentioned all of these different alterations, mutations. How do we identify those? Well, we're looking for the DNA from the tumor cells, not the DNA from the normal cells, because again, these are mutations that happened that turn the cell into tumor. And we can look at that a various ways, but maybe a somewhat overly simplistic way of looking at it, of talking about it, is saying we can look for specific mutations where we get the cancer DNA and we almost have like a well-crafted Velcro that will only bind to very specific exact sequences. So if we know we're looking for this exact sequence within the DNA, we can create a match to that, like a very specified magnet or Velcro to then capture that DNA. We can say, oh, yes, it has this DNA that we were looking for. Now, what's more commonly used now is saying, well, instead of having to specify all of them, can we just know the actual exact sequence of the DNA in any given point? And we can do that through something called next generation sequencing. So through next generation sequencing, we don't have to know what we're looking for. We can just get what is the exact sequence. And in that exact sequence, does that represent particular mutations? It can be common ones that we know to look for that we could have done by the other testing that I described. It can be uncommon or rare ones that we wouldn't have necessarily been looking for, but we're going to identify. Now, another benefit to using that next generation sequencing is that we can also look for all of these mutations and alterations. Well, mutations especially, alterations to the fusions to some extent. We can look for those as well, just with one block of tissue or one piece of the tissue, essentially being able to sequence out all of these different ones as opposed to multiple one-off tests. And given the number that we're now testing that are required as part of standard of care testing, because we have FDA-approved targeted therapies that can then treat those tumors, with the number that we're doing, the cost essentially starts really becoming in favor of doing next generation sequencing, where we can test for all of them with less tissue than just doing all these other one-off tests. Now, we can test for that in tissue by capturing the tumor DNA from the actual tumor cells in the tissue. We also can look for that in the bloodstream. So we can do a blood draw, and then in the blood can identify what is tumor DNA as compared to what is normal DNA floating through the bloodstream. And so this is one of the big advances in the last 10 years now, is to be able to test for that in the blood. Now, there are benefits and challenges to both tissue testing as well as testing from a blood draw. From a blood draw is obviously much more accessible than having to do a biopsy, although we're doing a biopsy to get the initial diagnosis, so we often have the tissue in that setting. There are scenarios where we have captured that DNA that we're looking for, that the tumor DNA in a blood draw that didn't show up in the tissue biopsy. And that can be because of variation in that tumor across the body, that different sites can have some variations in those mutations. And by doing a blood draw, we're actually going to capture all of that tumor DNA that sheds into the bloodstream to get a more broad look. At the same time, we could also have tumor sites that aren't shedding so much, where the biopsy, we're going to see that mutation in the tumor tissue DNA, but it's not really shedding into the bloodstream, and so we're not going to see it there. And you know, we could have a whole hour discussion just on that topic. Just so maybe rather than dive further into that, I'll just broadly say that there are real benefits from doing the tissue biopsy and the tissue testing for the DNA, as well as real benefits to being able to do the blood-based testing. And I think in the future, that blood-based testing, we can even then utilize for other avenues of decision making and seeing how much shed is there really that can have an impact on what our expectations are as to the likelihood of spread, or even in really totally different ways, looking at very, very subtle as a way of potentially screening or part of stratifying how we're going to treat in a more early stage setting. That's more of a research arena, but this is accessible in both avenues.
Great, great. So the patients with these targeted mutations, we talked about how well they respond, but their response varies. We know a few patients will sometimes achieve a complete remission, others are partial responders, and yet some have really no objective response to therapy. And even with our most effective agents, I've seen numbers that say about 70 to 80% of response rates can be expected. Now, the tumors seem to get a degree of either primary resistance, the ones that don't respond at all, but we also know some acquire resistance after some initial response. Can you discuss some of the mechanisms and how we then approach these patients who develop resistance or have resistance?
So you're right. I mean, 78% is pretty good. That means that the tumor is shrinking by more than 30% for that number. So to have what's called a partial response means that the tumor volume has to have gotten smaller by at least 30%. Now, those that have the tumor that decreases by 10%, for example, doesn't mean that that's not also going to be controlled for a long time. And so I try to specify that, especially when talking with patients about this, because sometimes how much things shrank, people have this idea that then that means it's going to work for longer. And that's not always the case. But on top of those high response rates is we also see some real durability, that with some of these targeted therapies, most people have years of disease control, which is a huge advance, especially when those targeted drugs are a pill, which they overwhelmingly are, and generally don't cause as much in the way of side effects as the chemotherapy. Now, that's not entirely true, and there is broad variation. Some of them really don't cause much in the way of side effects. Others can cause multiple potential side effects. So it's hard to talk about it as one big bucket because there is a lot of variability between the different targets. Now, but the resistance can come from multiple different mechanisms. And one important one to highlight is the potential development of a different genomic alteration or mutation that we can also target. So when somebody is on a targeted therapy and we're seeing growth of the cancer in multiple sites, then a blood-based test is a really easy way to then look for other mutations that might have come up that are sometimes a different one that we can target with a different pill. And so that genomic testing is extremely important at the time of progression. But also to highlight, I've mentioned that the mutations can be different at different sites. And so if I have somebody that's on a targeted therapy and it's working really well everywhere, and now I see one nodule that is growing when everything else is controlled, well, that would be something we'd consider radiating or cutting out as one site where maybe there were some mutations that occurred in that tumor that now is making it resistant to the treatment, whereas all the other tumors are still responding. Now, if we see that happen at a lot of different sites, then that is a more widespread resistance mechanism that has occurred, and therefore people need to go on the next treatment line. And that's where that blood-based test becomes really important. Now, if the blood-based test does not show anything particularly convincing, then one has to consider, okay, do we do a biopsy now to look at the tissue and maybe this alteration that has occurred, this mutation that's occurred, is not something that's shedding into the bloodstream. And so we're not detecting it on a blood-based test, but we might then be able to detect it from a biopsy.
Got it. So you kind of mentioned that targeted agents were initially presumed to be relatively non-toxic since they are disrupting the cancer-specific target. But we know that these drugs tend to be used chronically, as you mentioned, sometimes years. And we know now that some toxicities do occur. Can you talk a little bit about what's sometimes called on-target or off-target side effects with these drugs and how they can sometimes impact the patient journey?
So essentially, when there's a mutation, and let me use EGFR for example, a mutation in the code for the EGFR receptor, when there's a mutation in that, it can change the shape of that receptor on the cell surface. So if you have a drug that can lock into that specific receptor, but doesn't fit into the normal receptor. So, an EGFR that does not have the mutation has a receptor that's a different shape. And if the drug ends up not really locking with that, then you don't get the effect of the drug on those normal cells. You only get it on the cells with the mutation with the altered receptor. You can kind of think of it like a key and lock, because I've been saying lock, but a key and lock. And so if you have a key that will only fit into a lock that has the mutations that the cancer cells have, then it's going to be very specific. If that lock can sometimes still, or if that key can sometimes still fit into the lock of the normal EGFR, not having the mutation, well, then that's going to affect the normal cells also. So you want it to be very specific. So on target is where you're hitting a target and then having some of the toxicities. Off target can be where you have other toxicities that aren't related to the receptor itself. So, for example, with EGFR, The prior treatments that we utilized was either erlotinib or gefitinib. These drugs more commonly would end up hitting the normal EGFR than something like osimertinib, which is a bit more specific. So the side effects of osimertinib are less. We see less diarrhea, and we see less skin issues with osimertinib than we saw with erlotinib and gefitinib, because erlotinib and gefitinib can affect those normal EGFR receptors a bit more than the osimertinib. Now, if we talk about things like antibody drug conjugate is also, it can be like a targeted chemotherapy where the chemotherapy is bound to an antibody. That antibody is something that essentially seeks out that lock. So it's like a different key to lock where it binds or grabs that receptor on the surface of the cancer cells that then pulls it inside the cell where it then releases the chemotherapy into the cell. But if you have some of that chemotherapy that ends up in the bloodstream and goes more broadly, that can affect other vulnerable cells as well. And so, what we're talking about is targeted therapy, just opening that idea up to we're talking about all the targeted treatments. And that conversation is becoming even more broad with some of these other novel new agents.
Very good. You're correct. It is getting broader, and we'll probably need another podcast in the future to discuss it more broadly. So I want to switch gears a little bit, especially because you're being a spokesperson for the American Lung Association. During November, Lung Cancer Awareness Month, the American Lung Association releases its annual signature report, State of Lung Cancer. So it was just released this November. And this provides a state-specific understanding of the burden of lung cancer and opportunities to address this deadly disease in each of the states. The report also serves as both a guidepost and a rallying call, providing policymakers, researchers, healthcare practitioners, as well as people diagnosed with lung cancer, their caregivers, and others committed to ending lung cancer by identifying where states can best focus resources in order to decrease this toll of lung cancer. Categories that are looked at in this signature report include the number of new cases, survival rate, early diagnosis, surgical treatment, lack of treatment, as well as screening rates. And it also talks about the racial disparities that exist. Now, this year, the report introduced a new feature looking at insurance coverage of comprehensive biomarker testing, which we're talking about. The report found that only 15 states require insurance coverage of comprehensive biomarker testing. Five states require some plans to cover testing, and 30 states and Washington, D.C. have yet to require any coverage of biomarker testing. And we know that, as we discussed earlier, the National Comprehensive Cancer Network guidelines talk about how important it is to get tumor testing or biomarker testing done. Some numbers I saw were that an estimated 40 to 50% of patients with non-small cell lung cancer have a biomarker that may indicate that they're candidates for these targeted therapies we're talking about. Based on some available research, approximately 70% of these patients are tested for their biomarker. So there are some gaps. Dr. Sands, based on your familiarity with the literature, as well as your work with professional societies, do you see these estimates as being fairly accurate? And aside from the issue of insurance coverage and costs, what are some of the other hurdles for patients to get biomarker testing that may represent those 30% that are not being treated?
Well, first of all, that State of Lung Cancer is such a wonderful report. And I look forward to that each year to get more of a sense of what's going on. There's the State of Lung Cancer Treatment that you're reporting to. There's also the whole element of lung cancer screening, which of course has been a very active area as well. And so it is a very nice kind of benchmark each year to get a sense of where we're at. And I know there's a tremendous amount of work that goes into such a nuanced an informational report. So I do look forward to that. And this is true. I mean, we know that genomic testing should happen for everybody with a non-squamous, non-small cell lung cancer. Certainly everybody with metastatic or stage four disease. And increasingly, there are reasons to test for these in earlier stage disease as well. Although, that's a whole other separate discussion. So everything I'm saying now, I'm going to stick to metastatic. That doesn't mean that there's no relevance to earlier stage. There certainly is, especially with particular alterations that now have approval for targeted therapy, even with earlier stage disease. We know that the testing is not happening, though, for everyone in metastatic. And on top of that, I'd just add, anyone with squamous cell lung cancer or even small cell lung cancer that does not have a smoking history, or I'd say even a very limited and remote history, I would get genomic testing, and I think that's important. Now, we don't think of these alterations as showing up in something like small cell lung cancer, but I have seen that. I've seen a patient with MET exon 14 skipping mutation. I've seen a patient with EGFR mutation with sensitizing mutation where we know the targeted therapy is typically effective. And there are certainly others that have shown up. And so this testing is overwhelmingly important in identifying what's the right treatment for patients. Now, as far as how much of it is being done, it varies widely. And for the last more than 10 years, there's been a lot of discussion about how do we make the testing happen more regularly? How can we help make sure that everyone's getting this testing? And, you know, there had been a thought as in, oh, we just need to educate more of the oncologists. But I think what you're uncovering is at this point a bigger issue is that oncologists know they need to do this testing, but having it covered and being able to get it through the system without patients getting some huge unpayable bill can sometimes be challenging. Now, across centers, you know, I'm at a large academic center where I benefit tremendously from a lot of infrastructure and support and such. But in the community centers, where there isn't as much of that infrastructure of support, in some cases, the pathology department is defining how that testing is done. And that is driven very much by what happens as far as insurance coverage and what's going to end up being a risk within departments. That hospitals are trying to make sure that they're able to maintain sufficient testing so that they can get all the testing done, then it's not falling to them. And so there are companies that things can get sent out to, and then reimbursement becomes an issue for that and patients not getting bills. Essentially, I guess I'm kind of winding around the quagmire of some of this because it is a bit complicated. And as a clinician, frankly, I prefer to not get bogged down into the insurance coverage aspects. But that has real implications to testing being done and patients not ending up with a bill. So those are surprising numbers to me as far as the number of states not identifying coverage. And I know that this is a complicated issue within hospitals around medical oncology groups and pathology groups in making sure that that testing gets adequately done. It sounds like there's a lot more work to do.
Right. And just to add to that, I noted before we had our pre-call discussion that this month's Chest Journal had an article that talked about pulmonologists and how they vary in ordering their biomarkers. And many of them defer that responsibility to individuals like you, to the oncologist, because even though they have the role of bronchoscopy and the societal guidelines from CHEST and ATS exist, many pulmonologists defer the leadership of this biomarker testing to the oncologist. They feel that they don't have the underlying resources that you mentioned or the multidisciplinary infrastructure required to efficiently accomplish the biomarker testing. Have you observed that at all in your practice, or what's your thoughts on that observation from that CHEST journal?
Absolutely. And I think on some level, that's fair, is that if you're ordering testing on everybody and it ends up being a scenario where it's not going to impact clinical decision making and it's not covered and the patient ends up getting a bill or something like that, I think that ends up, you know, your prior question highlights the challenges for anyone outside of medical oncology ordering these tests and knowing that yes, it's approved in this scenario, and yes, it's going to be utilized. At the same time, medical oncologists across the country are requesting that all this testing be done up front so that when they meet the patient, they say, oh, we have all the testing and here's what we do, as opposed to saying, okay, here's the diagnosis, but we need this other test and it's going to take a few weeks
Right.
for us to have the result of that. You know, when people have a cancer diagnosis and they meet their medical oncologist, they want to start now. And so often there are discussions around saying, yes, I want to start as soon as possible as well, but I want to make sure we're starting you on the best treatment for you and not just the first treatment for you. Now, that way of speaking about it, usually patients say, oh, absolutely, I want the best treatment too. But sometimes we do need to urgently start something. And if we urgently need to start something, I'd advocate that we start chemotherapy alone and not add any immunotherapy until we have that genomic testing back. Because the genomic testing is really important. It can have implications. And if you start immunotherapy and then want to start some kind of targeted therapy, sometimes there are real risks that are added for that reason. So medical oncologists want this pushed faster and earlier. But yes, other groups feel like they're not sure what's covered and what's important. So then they end up not wanting to order that without the direct guidance from oncology. And that is an ongoing discussion that's being handled differently in different institutions across the country.
Great message. So, based on our discussion, the future of thoracic oncology seems to be shifting definitely toward increased molecular testing and the use of these targeted therapies. And for the most part, these novel drugs have proven to be safe and effective. But we've heard about some challenges. Do you have any closing comments today, Dr. Sands? And again, I want to thank you so much for taking the time.
Well, just to highlight what a huge advance this is. 15 years ago, if you had said that we're going to be sitting here talking about a number of different genomic alterations, and for many of those alterations, there are now multiple drugs that are FDA approved as targeted therapies and pills. This is a huge advance. Of course, there's also immunotherapy, which we haven't touched on in this discussion. There's antibody drug conjugates now is the era where we're entering as well. And so we have multiple avenues of science that are coming together and leading to more and better performing novel treatments. I reiterate that because I think sometimes people are under the impression that not much has changed in cancer in decades, when in fact, over the last 10, 15 years, it is a completely different field. And there's a lot for all the oncologists to keep up on with this more rapidly advancing field, but it is bringing better and better treatment to patients.
Well, again, thank you for your time today, and also thank you for the work you do with the American Lung Association. And to our listeners, if you want to hear more regarding all things respiratory related, we've developed a great archive of discussions on our show feeds. So be sure again to subscribe and rate Lungcast on your preferred listening or watching platform, and visit lung.org and hcplive.com for more news and resources. And until next time, I'm Dr. Albert Rizzo reminding you that if you can't breathe, nothing else matters.